Okay, now this is the second tape of the interview with Mr. Ramses Nassif. We were just talking about your trip to Cairo when Nasser had requested the removal of UNEF, and you had, now let me understand this correctly, but you had mentioned to Uthant that he might meet privately with Nasser. Is that correct?
No, I had asked actually before he had taken his decision to withdraw UNEF. If, and it was his idea, he had intended to appeal to Nasser to reconsider his decision. And I was all for it. But he, Uthant, mentioned this to the Egyptian ambassador. His name was Mohammed El-Kouni, and El-Kouni said he would like to check with Cairo. So this whole procedure, you know, you are going to appeal, you appeal directly without going through the bureaucratic channels, as he did in the case of Cuba. He appealed directly to Gorbachev and to Kennedy. He didn't go through Stevens.
Okay. So let me just make sure I understand this correctly. So that he left Cairo then at that point and had gone back to New York.
No, this was before we went to Cairo. I'm the one who was creating this confusion. That was before we went to Cairo. That was before he had even decided to withdraw UNEF.
Okay.
He told me that he was thinking of appealing to President Nasser to reconsider his decision to withdraw UNEF from Egypt.
I see.
At that point, I said that I think it's an excellent idea. We were alone, of course. I mean, I wouldn't do this in front of anybody else. We were alone. I said that it's an excellent idea, so that we go through it. But when he mentioned it to the ambassador of Egypt, the ambassador really said he would check with the government. And the government said that he better not, if he did appeal, we were going to rebuff his appeal. So he decided, on the advice of Bunch, not to appeal. Water under the bridge.
All right, so okay. That was before he had actually gone to Cairo.
Yeah, before. Okay. And so he didn't decide to withdraw the unit. He went to Cairo, and then in Cairo he made this proposal to Nasser. He accepted, provided that Israel would accept.
Okay. And so, actually, in this whole process, when was the final decision taken to withdraw UNEF? UNEF.
You mean the date?
Yeah, the date.
The date of he...
Was it after he had come back from Cairo?
No, before.
He had actually...
He had taken
the decision to withdraw So what was the purpose then of the trip to Cairo?
The purpose of the trip to Cairo to see what he could, if he could save the situation breaking into open hostilities.
Okay.
Because especially after the closure of the Strait of Tiran, which Israel took as a hostile action, and indeed they followed up. War broke out on the 5th of June.
On the 5th of June. Yes. And you had been there May.
In May? Yes, in May. Yes. We came back in May. we came back on May the 20th. May the 25th, late at night. May the 25th. And he reported immediately to the Security Council. The Security Council met several times, and they discussed his report. And in the report he was very gloomy, because he expected something terrible to happen. It did. And in the early hours of June 5th, Cairo time, the third Middle East war broke out.
Now, had the UN peacekeepers actually been withdrawn by the time that the war broke out?
No, when the war broke out, not all of them. not all of them. Some of them were, and in fact there were a few casualties in Gaza, if I remember correctly, a few Indians, 4 or 5 or 6 who were killed in the exchange of fire between the Israelis and the Egyptians. But they were complete with low and was affected afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course we knew what happened to us.
Right.
June the 5th at the rest of it.
But the troop contributing countries basically were in favor of withdrawing.
Yes, yeah. Yes. The only country.
So there was no effort on their part to keep the troops there.
No, there were no efforts. The Canadians were reluctant, but they didn't really try to stay on because. If they did, the whole thing would be misconstrued as an occupation force
mm-hmm.
against the way we were attacking. But then again, after that, we've heard so many stories about was Nasser really serious in making this move? Was it a question of just withdrawing from certain sectors and not the entire force as intimated by the Egyptian general in his initial request for generality. And a lot of things were said about that, and I think there were summed up beautifully by the Dr. Mahmoud Fawzi. He's a different Fawzi from the general, same, but it's practically. The confusion in Egypt during that fateful decision was described by Dr. Fawzi. This Dr. Fawzi was a former foreign minister of Egypt, and he was the advisor to the president on foreign affairs. Gross miscalculations based on gross misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an Egyptian person.
Mm-hmm.
Just to sort of typify the mood that was prevailing. And in Nasser's, when he took that decision, he did not consult him. He did not consult his foreign minister. His foreign minister knew about it from Ufant, because Ufant called him the Egyptian ambassador, who didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Egyptian ambassador got in touch with his foreign minister, and that's how this whole thing is described to you. But it's a very long story.
Yeah. So this was actually a decision that had been made between Nasser and his general.
And his general, exactly.
Yeah, okay. And not involved the foreign minister.
The foreign minister. Not the foreign minister. More the civilian advisors, like Mr. Fawzi. Did
now,
I talk too much?
No. Now I wanted to ask you some questions about, now we're going to another area of the world, Vietnam.
Yes.
Because the Vietnam War was going on during the tenure of U Thant.
Yes.
And U Thant was from Asia, from the region. What was U Thant's involvement in
involvement was without any mandate whatsoever, because neither North Vietnam nor South Vietnam were members of the United Nations. Not China for that matter, because China, that was a member, was Formosa.
That's right.
Yeah, the People's Republic of China joined way.
Not until the 70s, yeah.
Yeah, 71, yeah. October 71, they joined. But his involvement was in the fact that there was a war going on. He felt very strongly that the war and hostilities were not solved, and it will only be solved through political negotiations, and he made that made that declaration so many times at every opportunity, at every, all his talks with the world leaders, including, of course, Washington, and London, and Moscow. And he didn't get anywhere. He had very sympathetic response from Stevenson. But Stevenson, as you know, was just an ambassador to the UN. Mm-hmm. It's true he was a member of the cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
But Dean Rusk would not cooperate. And in fact, there was a case, this is a very serious matter, so I know exactly what I'm saying, of a proposal that he received, was not received from the North Vietnamese for talks,
mm-hmm.
that he passed on to Stevenson, and Stevenson passed on to Dean Rusk.
Yeah.
And Dean Rusk turned it down without referring to it.
The wind.
Without referring it to President Johnson.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all his attempts really did not bear any fruit. He felt frustrated and he tried several times. Even at one time, Pope Paul VI, who had visited the UN, and he had a very nice rapport with Mitterrand, and he came to address the generous and learned education of Mitterrand, wanted to go to visit the north and the south of Vietnam as a gesture of goodwill,
mm-hmm.
of peace. And he used Mitterrand as a sort of go-between, just to see his good offices, to see if you, such a visit would be welcome.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And Ho Chi Minh turned it down. And we found it was the French. The French gave us a transmitted this message from the Pope,
mm-hmm.
to Hanoi. He turned it down on the fact that he would not, his government would not be able to secure the safety of the Pope.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Pope, of course, gave up that idea, said you could go to the south and go to the north.
So the appeals to Uthan from Vietnam, who did they come from?
They're not appeals, they're messages to be passed on to the men. They came from Hanoi.
From Hanoi.
And from the National Liberation Front, which was the South.
Yeah.
The communists in the South fighting against the government.
I see, okay.
Yeah. And he had a channel with them through Paris.
Because
Paris had a diplomatic relations with Hanoi throughout.
I see, okay, yeah. And were they a request for the United Nations to
no request of, no because they were not members of the UN, a request to pass on that they were ready to talk,
uh-huh.
to talk.
Uh-huh.
But at that point, the American government was not interested in any negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
They thought they should concentrate on helping preserve the government in the South. And they turned down this, and some of them were turned down at the level of Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
Was Dean Rusk at the time.
Yeah.
Without referring to, but he found that out much later when it was too late.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very interesting. I wanted to ask you...
But here, perhaps, in to keep... on April 3rd, 1968, press dispatches quoted Hanoi Radio as saying that North Vietnam was ready to meet American representatives to consider the end of the fighting. To keep up the peace momentum, Uthan maintained his contacts with Washington and Hanoi and suggested Paris, Geneva, Warsaw as a possible venue for the talks.
Mm-hmm.
Agreement was soon reached to begin the peace talks in Paris on May 10, 1968.
Mm-hmm.
The talks were protracted and difficult, but five years later, a preliminary agreement was reached through the new administration in Washington, which was Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
The Richardson with Henry Kissinger heading the U.S. delegation. And that was that at the time.
Okay.
Five, I mean, he didn't really live to see the end of this war.
Tell me something about Outhant as a person and working with him all those years. And actually, could you explain his name? What does it mean?
Who is for those, the first name, carry the U, the U.
Oh,
the U.
Okay.
And Thant literally means small brother.
Okay.
So, but when he signed, you know, official papers, he never signed it Outhant, because he was sort of a title, if you like.
Uh-huh.
He would sign M-E-U-N-G. I'll show you a signature.
Okay, M-E-U-N-G?
Yeah, Neung Thant.
Oh, okay. Is U somewhat similar to Mr., but it really means first son?
It's first son, but it's real, if you like, yes, as a sort of
Mr. But only it can only be used if you are the first son.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly, yes.
And was Thant his family name?
No, his Thant was his given name.
Thant was his given name. Okay.
No family name is used. Uh-huh. And then when he signed Neung.
And what is Neung?
Neung is a small brother.
I can just turn. We were just looking for how he signed his name.
Yes,
yeah.
And then he was an extremely human person. I remember so many instances, for example, when he arrived in Cairo during that very critical moment. I stayed, of course, with him at the night hotel where the different government put us up.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was ailing in Heliopolis. It's quite a distance from Cairo. So I asked him if I could. He had asked us all to meet for a working dinner.
Mm-hmm.
If you would excuse me, just to use one of the official cars that they put at his disposal to go see my mother.
Mm-hmm.
He said, by all means. And then came back. So that was the first thing he asked me. He said, how is your mother? How is she feeling? And I hope you give her my best wishes. I said, indeed I do. And every morning when we're on a trip, for example, the first thing he would ask is, did you sleep well? Were you comfortable?
Mm-hmm.
He was an extremely human person and very quiet, but underneath it all, he was a very strong personality. And one, again, I will be quoting from this is Brian Eckert again. In his personal account of his association with Outhant, as his press spokesman, Ramses Masih has called the very human and unusual quality of Outhant's personality, his strong sense of duty, the vital part that his Buddhist faith played in his life, his emphasis on morality and the importance of moral behavior, his extraordinary lack of anger, resentment, or envy, and his personal kindness and considerateness. And I remember vividly when I was the bearer of bad news, he lost his son, his only son, in fact, in a very cruel accident. He fell off a bus in Rangoon.
Mm.
And the following day, the son was supposed to come and join his parents in New York and go to college in New York.
Oh.
So it was a horrible episode, really. And the only reason I had to do this is Bruce Mann, an American journalist who was very fond of the film, was the chief bureau of UPI at the UN headquarters in New York. So he saw that, what did they call it, a bulletin in his wire. So he stopped the bulletin and took up and tell me about it so that I informed Kofant first, because Kofant was in the habit of listening to the news every hour.
Oh, I see. So he didn't want him to find out,
to find
over,
out
the radio.
Over the radio.
Oh,
so I went to see him, and on my way I said, why should I be alone to be the voice of doom? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Harasimha if he would come along with me.
Yes, yeah.
And he came, and we went in, and he was, he has this squawk box, he had a squawk box in his office,
mm-hmm.
where he could switch on and listen to the meetings, and as well as the news.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying with a big smile, you know, nothing works in the Secretary General's office,
mm-hmm.
because it wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at us and said, so we informed him. The first thing he said, I wonder how my wife would take this news.
Mm-hmm.
He was completely composed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it would be a shock to anybody.
Yeah.
His own reason. But just as, I guess, an act of God, or whatever you want to call it, the same year that he lost his son, his daughter, his other child, but they have a son and daughter, AA, that gave birth to a boy. So it was, you know, sort of, apparently is very significant to do this religion. Death takes.
Yes, yes. Were the major powers pleased with the work that you thought had carried out? Or
he was in very good relations with all of them. He managed to strike a friendship with Hitcher.
Mm-hmm.
His first visit, in fact, Hitcher invited him to his Tasha in Yalta, and he invited to the family, you thought of Santa Fe, to have a swim with him,
uh-huh.
and to have a family dinner with him, his wife.
Oh.
And the rest of us, we ate at a separate table with some other dips. And he got along very well with President Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it was a short life, I mean, it was, you
know,
President Kennedy was assassinated in 63.
Mm-hmm.
With Johnson, I think he had a good working relationship. I don't think he and Dean Rusk were on the best of terms. He was a very close friend of Stevenson. There really was a very deep friendship. The British was Attlee, Prime Minister Attlee.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, he got along well with De Gaulle. De Gaulle and Hammersley never got along.
Yeah, yeah.
And De Gaulle used to call the United Nations the disunited nations. But at the first meeting with De Gaulle, they hit it well and invited him to a private luncheon of the Elysee and a tete-a-tete with only the interpreter present, and what he called English perfectly because he didn't
manipulate
the war. And they got along fine. Of course, with the Chinese, they were not in the Chinese, I mean.
Yeah, the mainland China.
Mainland China.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in good terms with the representative of China, Formosa, the Republic of China. Yes, I think the answer is yes.
Now, I understand that he was often not feeling well.
Yes.
What was his, what
well,
were
he, asked,
he
suffered
from
an ulcer. He suffered from an ulcer. And in fact, it was during the last months of his second term that he fell ill. He was planning a big trip to China after to Beijing, after Beijing to join the UN in October 71.
Mm-hmm.
So he was planning to go in November. And this sort of to crown his all the efforts he had made for the defeating of China, and he wanted to know this is the one place and one permanent member of the Security Council that he did not have a chance to visit because he couldn't go to mainland China when mainland China was not a member.
Right.
And everyone around him, when I asked him, I said, I hope you are including me in this trip.
Yes.
And because this is history.
Right? Yes, yes.
He said, of course you're coming from Tramsis. You know how many people you asked already. I said, no, it's 10. And I don't like big parties, as you know. I said, yes, sir. He said, you see, everyone who comes and he says, I want to go with you. This is important. I said, yes, and I cannot go back home. That very day, he fell right office. We had to carry him by ambulance to a hospital in Fifth Avenue. And he was suffering from a bleeding ulcer. He stayed in hospital for 6 weeks.
Oh.
And when he came back, and then the Chinese wanted to bring their credentials, to present the credentials to him.
Yes, yes.
So at the time, they were employing someone called Storm White. You might have heard the name, a very famous writer who was, this is a very interesting episode. If you are interested only, because I don't want to, if not, we'll forget it.
No, they wanted to bring their credentials
to him in the hospital. They wouldn't. They wouldn't give it to anybody else.
I see. And these were the last few weeks of his tenure as Secretary General.
Yes.
Yeah.
In November. Yes.
And they were anxious to become members.
Yes. the membership issue has been settled. Mm-hmm. They have been seated.
But formally, they had
to
present their credentials
so
to the Secretary General.
They wanted to do it personally to him, which they did at the hospital, and he agreed, of course.
And so their ambassador went to the hospital?
To the hospital. The three of them came to the hospital.
Uh-huh,
And they did it there, and because they did not want to deal with the Indian chargé d'affaires, because, you know, China and India at the time were not on the best terms.
Uh-huh.
So they used me as a vehicle to make the appointment
for
them.
Instead of going through Narasimhan?
Instead of going through Narasimhan.
They went through you?
Through me.
Yeah.
And of course, I informed the chief of protocol, and he didn't like the idea. And I said, listen, the request is with the Secretary General. If he wants to do it, he will do it. He said, this is not protocol. He said, no, but your job is to inform her seaman, by all means inform him, but that's what is happening, and he has a request. So if he wants to see them, it's up to him.
Yeah. And so he saw him in the hospital.
He robbed the shop.
And so did he come back to his office?
He came back to the office for a few weeks.
For a few weeks.
But he was weak.
Uh-huh,
he was
uh-huh.
weak. At that time, there was a move to recruit him for a third term, of course.
Okay, okay.
Of course, it was out of question.
Out of the question because of his health.
Of his health.
Yeah.
But they really wanted him to to consider it, you know, and they saw that. I cannot, I'd be lucky to survive.
Yeah.
And then at that time, they discovered that he had developed this horrible disease.
So what was the disease? Oh, he had cancer.
If you turn this off, I can tell you something.
But he did not ever get to go to China. He did not manage the trip.
He had been to China long before he became septuagenarian.
Uh-huh.
As with the Prime Minister Onu to visit China.
Mm-hmm.
He knew, but he never went to China as Secretary
General. Well, we could, I just wanted to ask you, just looking back at those years, how would you summarize Mouthant's contribution?
Well, I say that on not as spokesman for anybody but myself.
Mm-hmm.
I think as of today, Dag Hammarskjöld and Mouthant will go down in history as the two greatest of the United Nations. And I have a very strong feeling that Kofi Annan, the present Secretary General, after his brilliant and untiring efforts that
mm-hmm.
saved the Middle East from another bombing or whatever you want to call it,
yes,
may very well be on his way.
Mm-hmm.
But of course it's too early really to pass any judgment. But I think he did a wonderful thing in negotiating the agreement to Baghdad.
And what's it, what was the quality of Mouthant that made him a really good Secretary General? Or what kinds of qualities do you think that office requires?
I think his sense of integrity, honesty, straightforward, and good personal courage and good judgment.
Mm-hmm.
He had all that.
And people had confidence in him?
People had confidence.
How was he as an administrator? Because originally the position of Secretary General was intended to be the administrator.
As an administrator, he was not that good at all. He left everything in the hands of C.D. Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the the black spot, I guess, you right. That was his weakness. I wouldn't call it black spot. That was his weakness. Administration, he gave a lot of authority to C.V. Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
This is one thing that Hammarskjöld had. He was interested in management, and although he delegated a lot of authority, he did not delegate as much to Andrew Cordier, for example,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
who was his executive assistant.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else that you would particularly like to add that we somehow didn't cover?
No, I think we've covered
pretty thorough. Well, thank you so much. I really
it's my pleasure.
It.
And if you still want to go to lunch,
yes.
I just want to make one thing.
Did you want to add something to
no,
the
no,
table?
No.
No.
No.